We invite you this morning to turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, where we will be continuing our study. We need to be earnestly remembering in prayer our brother and sister Larry and Linda Payden, who have arrived safely in Tula. But if you've ever moved to a new place, and it was even the same culture and people speaking the same language that you had spoken since your birth, and you know the dislocations that come and the stresses that are a part of it, then you can have some idea of what it's like to move to a totally new culture in circumstances that are strange and with a language that is not your native tongue. I put information in news and notes about writing and calling them. If you have difficulty calling, we'll try to work out that, call your operator. You can have some interesting experiences in international calling. So if we've got wrong information, we were able, by virtue of it, to get to Tula. Now we'll see what we can do. I've mentioned something that Larry said when we were talking and I asked him what he needed. He said light bulbs. I don't advise you to try to send anybody UPS. I doubt if anyone would arrive in the whole piece. But he was feeling that on Saturday morning when he woke up and realized, I suppose, that in that apartment there were very few or no light bulbs. It was very bare. I want especially to stress today that we should remember Mindy Schaaf and remember Mike and Cindy. They're having a challenging time getting that dear young lady off that ventilator, and we want to redouble our efforts in prayer for not only Mindy, but for Mike and Cindy. We began our study 2 weeks ago in Ecclesiastes. Some people look at this book and say, what a terrible song of cynicism and despair. Vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. Emptiness. Others look at it and see what I believe is clearly present. A song of confidence and assurance in the midst of many puzzling and perplexing things. Thomas Wolfe, in a book that is very familiar, You Can't Go Home Again or Alone. For of all that I have ever seen or learned, that book seems to be the noblest, the wisest, and the most powerful expression of man's life upon this earth, and also the highest flower of poetry, eloquence, and truth. I am not given to dogmatic judgments in the matter of literary creation, but if I had to make one, I could say that Ecclesiastes is the greatest single piece of writing I have ever known, and the wisdom expressed therein the most lasting and profound. That's from a contemporary writer. I hope you will see what wisdom for the ages there is in this remarkable book. We said that the title that's been given to it, Ecclesiastes, is because in the book, the writer identifies himself as the preacher. Literally, that means one who is a master of an assembly, one who guides an assembly, one who speaks to an assembly. And so Ecclesiastes is saying that in Greek, one who speaks to the church, that is, a gathered out body. The reason this book is powerful is because it is from God. But beyond that, it is written by one who was able beyond anything that we could ever hope to achieve. Any one of us. He was able, he had resources to experience life more fully and profoundly than any of us. And it is his conclusion about all that experience that we are reading in Ecclesiastes. I said, as we began, that this is a book for young people. That doesn't mean that those of us who are no longer young cannot find some really significant insights here. And especially, I might say, not just find them, but be reminded of them. But I believe Solomon wrote to young people. He wanted them not to go down the dead-end streets and blind alleys that he himself had followed. And if you begin to think, after we consider these things this morning, that, well, I know other people have tried it and failed, but I will not fail. I ask you the question that Solomon raises in this book, what shall the man do who comes after the king? He was the wealthiest and the wisest king who ever lived. And nothing you and I attempt to do will come remotely near what he was able to achieve. And he says, from beginning to the end of this book, everything under the sun is vanity and chasing the wind. Now that can sound cynical, filled with despair about everything. What's the use? But that's not what Solomon is saying. And anyone who reads this book with care will realize that that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, in view of the question that he raises, and that is, what shall a man do with his life under the sun? What profit is there in this life under the sun? And when he asks the question, what profit is there? He's not saying, is there any use to this? He's saying, is there any ultimate use to this? Is there any ultimate meaning to this? When I've invested my life in this particular thing, will I live my life to its end without regrets and face death without regret? Because it was worth everything. It is the ultimate value. And we need to ask ourselves that question, and sometimes we do. Maybe not just in that form. The last time we spoke on Ecclesiastes, we said that Solomon tells us that the world in which we live is a world that is filled with perplexities and pain, with mysteries that we cannot solve, and that it has been subjected to vanity. And we gave some illustrations of that, and we may discuss a few of those today. But what we want to talk about today is the search that he made. The world we live in is a world of great perplexity, and Solomon says that that is the case. And he says we are destined as human beings to know some grievous anxieties and pains. And yet, the search for the eternal good is one that all of us must enter upon. We're made that way. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, that he's put eternity in our hearts. That can be translated the world in our hearts. But by that, he means he put something ultimate in us. This search for something more than momentary satisfaction. We cannot live by bread alone. It's not enough, and the effort to make it enough will really increase the agony of the human spirit. But there are agonies. Solomon doesn't disguise that. In fact, you read the Bible, and from beginning to end, there is no effort to say life should be effortless, painless, simple, without any kind of disappointment, without any heartbreak or heartache. In fact, the Bible declares that there will be heartaches and there will be heartbreak. And our challenge is to see through all that what is real, what is lasting, what is meaningful. Solomon's experience in the search for ultimate good in things under the sun. Now, that's one of the key verses, key expressions here in Ecclesiastes. Things under the sun. That means what is here, what you can see, what you experience of the material world. Is there anything in this material world, Solomon asked, that is worth everything you've got? Worth your life. Something you can give in exchange for your life. That which is valuable beyond expression. And the answer that he gives is no. There isn't anything. And I want us to follow through this morning the experience of Solomon in that particular search for the ultimate. First of all, we raise the question, and I suppose this is where we ought to begin in the wise circumstance of this 20th century, when we think that we've really done some wonderful things in the world and that we have grown wise beyond all our predecessors. But Solomon says in the first chapter that he sought wisdom. He thought maybe that's what it is that will bring me ultimate satisfaction. Now, he's not talking about wisdom above the sun. He's talking about wisdom under the sun. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out my wisdom concerning all that is done under the sun. It is a sore travail that God has given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. That is to say, we've got this yearning in our hearts to know, and we search for it, and we exercise our own wisdom and intellect to achieve it, and we don't do it. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. Do you believe that? That's what we are challenged with. We bring our own intelligence and our own intellectual prowess to the puzzling perplexities of life, and Solomon says we can't figure it out. We can't straighten the crooked things, and we cannot fill up the things that are wanting. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I have gotten me great wisdom above all that were before me in Jerusalem. Yes, my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also was a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now that can sound like it can't be so. Now you want to understand that Solomon is not saying here that being shrewd or wise in a worldly way has no usefulness under the sun. He would tell you to go to school and do your lessons. He would tell you to take care of your studies and prepare yourself to earn an honorable living. He would say that you ought to work with industry, and does so. That laziness has no premium on it. The Solomon that wrote this would not commend some casting away of all responsibility that said, what difference does it make anyway? I'm not going to study, because if I study, it'll be pointless, and I won't get anything out of it. No, there's something to be gotten out of that. We'll take that up later. But today we're talking about, with Solomon, what is ultimately valuable. And he said, if you think you're going to build your life on this foundation by becoming wise after the ways of the world, human education, then you're grievously mistaken. If you think this will fill up the emptiness in your heart, that you'll get the ultimate answers to ultimate questions, he said, you are mistaken. I have tried it, and I got all the wisdom that a man could get virtually. At least, he says, I had more than any that were before me in Jerusalem. And all I got out of it was grief and sorrow. And why did he get grief and sorrow out of it? Because he tried to walk in the sight of his own eyes and the light of his own wisdom. And there's not enough wisdom and knowledge in the heart of a man to guide him. Jeremiah said it this way in the 10th chapter of his book. The way of a man is not in himself. It's not in man that walks to direct his own steps. So get as wise as you want to be. Go down to the University of Louisville. Go to Harvard. Go to Yale. Go to Oxford. Go to Cambridge. Go to any university on the face of the earth and take in all that they have to offer and all that generations past have preserved. And all of it together will not answer one important question, Solomon says. And because you make this what life is about, because you've decided if I can just know a little more, if I can know a lot more, if I can just fill my mind with all the knowledge that men have collected, that somehow or another I will at last be at peace. And I'll know ultimate truth and my life will be full. And he says it will not be full. It will be empty. Monotony under the sun. We talked about that last time. The way things keep on going around just the same way. And we don't have any influence over it. We live, we die, and we're forgotten, he said. Is that true? It is true. Do you know the name or the maiden name of your great-great-grandmother? Now, if you do, you will be remarkable. Do you know anything that your great-great-great-grandfather did? You'll be special if you do. If the world keeps on turning, you'll be somebody's great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother. And they won't know anything about you. And all that will remain in this world under the sun will be some marker somewhere in a cemetery that is being cared for by people that don't have any idea who you were. And even that will pass into the dust, as we know cemeteries and monuments have, gathered into the sand, no longer even known to mankind. That's the truth. For life under the sun, an endless cycle of events and monotony of repetition that seems to be going nowhere, and you're not going anywhere either, so far as we can tell, looking at life under the sun. If all we've got to look at is what we have here, if this is all there is, and Solomon says it is a blind, mindless monotony, and not only that, as we've already noted, an irremediable crookedness and emptiness that we cannot supply, that in our wisdom and canniness we have never been able to supply. Not all the men in human history together have been able to supply that. And he illustrates it by saying, fools and wise men come the same end. Now he's talking about wise after the world. Oh, he says the wise man's eyes are in his head. That is, he will be able to do some things more ably than the fool will do. But at last, fools and wise men wind up in the grave. Or as the English poet Gray said in his elegy written in the country churchyard, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. Man and beast, same end. They die. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes up or the spirit of the beast goes down. As we view life under the sun, that is exactly the case because you can't tell the difference. The dog dies in the cage. Your loved one dies. The body decays. As far as life under the sun is concerned, as we observe it here, that is the case. More than that, he says, in this world there is no justice because the strong oppress the weak, and the weak has no defender. That is true. All across this world, I guarantee you, there are people innocent with righteous causes who can be taken into the courts of men and stripped naked, and there will be no one to defend them. Wars and the ravages of war will kill innocent children again and again and again, and there will be nobody in this world under the sun to defend. The righteous will die and the wicked will live, he says. Righteous men and women will die early in their lives, and the wicked will absolutely live to be 100. Now, that isn't the way we think it ought to be. But that's the way often it is, at least sometimes it is in this world. And then he says, life is just uncertain. This may puzzle you a bit. This statement that is made by the preacher in the 9th chapter, verse 11. I returned and I saw under the sun, remember that key phrase, that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to all. Circumstances come that are beyond our control and cut off all our enterprises, no matter what our skill may be, no matter how great our wisdom, so far as this world is concerned, may be. That's what you see. And he says, worldly wisdom won't get you out of this mystery. It won't solve the problem because there are simply no answers to the question. Chapter 3, verse 11 says he put eternity in our hearts. But so we cannot find out what God's work is. We've got the questions, but we don't have the answer here under the sun. Chapter 12, verse 12, he speaks about the fact of the making of many books, there is no end. And much study is awareness of the flesh. And what he's saying here is, not that you ought not to do your schoolwork, but that if you think out of human volume and human wisdom, you're going to finally get the answer, you are mistaken. It is not there. No answer from human wisdom. Job chapter 11, in the words of Zophar, speaks to this matter of how in the world we're going to find wisdom. Canst thou by searching find out God? Zophar asks, can you find out the Almighty to perfection? It is as high as heaven, what can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? And what he's saying simply is that man, by his unaided wisdom, will not get the answers. They're not going to be any. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul speaks that very issue. He says that God has made foolish the wisdom of the wise. And it was God's good pleasure that man in his wisdom should not know God. But by the foolishness of the thing preached, he would save those that believed. In other words, all our striving to know and understand by our wisdom will reach nothing. But if only we would stop and listen to what he has said, that may by the standards of our wisdom seem weak and foolish, we will understand at last. But you have to sit down and close your mouth and listen to another who knows the answer. You don't know the answer. You don't know the answer to why you're here and what you need to do while you're here and where you're going. You don't have a clue to that. I don't have a clue to that under the sun by information I have here. But we persist as a society. And there are remnants of this in all our thoughts that somehow or another we will work it out for ourselves. We, by our own power and intelligence and wisdom, will achieve what Solomon did not achieve. We'll get the answers. You will not get the answers. Why not listen to someone who's been down that road? Why must we learn all lessons for ourselves? Why must we stick our head in the fire to find out that it burns? When others are telling us again and again that fire is hot, that it burns. Human beings are not too smart sometimes. What Paul writes in Romans 10, 6-9 addresses this very issue. He's talking about the gospel here, and he quotes from a passage in the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy, which talks about where the answers are and how you get those answers. He says in verse 6, but the righteousness which is of faith says this, say not in your heart, who shall ascend to heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who shall descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. Remember Zophar's question. How are you going to find out? It's higher than heaven. It's deeper than the abyss. He said, you know what? Paul said, you don't have to ascend into heaven. And you don't have to descend into the abyss. But what does it say, this righteousness by faith? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith, which we preach. Because if you shall confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord, and believe in your heart that God hath raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. It's that near. You don't have to go into heaven. You don't have to descend into the abyss. It's near you. And then he goes on to explain what he means in verse 11. For the scripture says, whosoever believes on him shall not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all and is rich toward all that call upon him. For whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall he preach unless he is sent? Even as is written, how beautiful the feet of them that bring bad tidings of good things. But they did not listen. They did not obey the glad tidings. For Isaiah said, Lord, who hath believed our report? So faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. The answers come from listening. Not from working it out by your own wisdom. And the one who speaks when we listen is the Lord. And we will struggle all our lifetime and get nothing when all we had to do was sit down and humbly listen to God. Well, there's another aspect of the pilgrimage of Solomon that we want to look at this morning. Solomon decided maybe worldly wisdom wasn't the way, but perhaps pleasure would do it. Chapter 2, I said in my heart, come now and I'll prove you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what does it do? I searched in my heart how to cheer my flesh with wine, and my heart yet guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what it was good for the sons of men that they should do unto the sun or unto the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I made pools of water, water there from the forest where trees were reared. I bought men servants and maid servants and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of herds and flocks above all that were before me in Jerusalem. I gathered me also silver and gold and the treasures of kings and of provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments and that of all sorts. And some versions translate that many concubines instead of musical instruments. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not from my heart from any. I withheld from my heart no joy, for my heart rejoiced because of all my labor, and this was my portion for all my labor. Then I looked on the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. I want you to think today about what you've got at home in your house. And I want you to ask yourself the question. Of all those pleasurable things you've accumulated, is it enough? Pleasure. There are pleasurable things in life. And a lot of them, in fact, all true pleasure is not in the illicit. God has given us many things that are pleasurable, and they are lawful. But if you think that you can take even these lawful pleasures, good food, going to delightful places, wonderful company that elates you and pleases you and gives you a sense of delight. If you think that that will satisfy the immense greatness of the eternal spirit that God has placed within you, that's as big as the world, bigger than the world itself, then you're mistaken, Solomon says. I had the resources to do anything, and I did it all, and I'm telling you, it's emptiness. when you try to make that the purpose of life. And we're going to find out the same Solomon that tells you that all this is emptiness will later tell you you ought to enjoy it while you have it. And thank God. But don't build your life here. He reminds us in the 12th chapter that we ought to seek while we're young our Creator. Before the days come, the day and years draw near, when you shall say, I have no pleasure in them. You know, the day is coming if we live to our full maturity, when it will be difficult to say that I really enjoy this day. When every movement of the body can bring pain. When the physical systems that sustain us have grown old and are beginning to wear out. When the eyes dim and the strength of legs and arms diminishes, and that which once was nothing to us becomes frightening and fearful and foreboding. If you've given yourself even to illicit pleasure, love of man for woman for a man, not to speak of illicit one, fornication and adultery. The day is going to come when the very body which was the instrument of those pleasures will have decayed. And will not be able even to enjoy that which you have made the center of life. We know this. Pleasure is not the answer. Sometimes the answer is pain. Sometimes it is through pain that we come to understand what real life is about. I think God uses it often to get our attention. Somebody says, well, Solomon said, maybe it's wealth. Well, you noticed in the reading that we did, we covered all that money. Solomon says a good bit about it. He had more of it than the rest of us will ever see. And what he says about money is the first problem about it is temporary. Very temporary. Chapter 2, verse 18, and I hated all my labor when I labored under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man that shall be after me. We know that. What are you collecting all this stuff for? And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool? Yet will he rule over all my labor when I labored. I'm going to do all this and collect it all, and then I'm going to give it to some idiot that doesn't have the foggiest idea what it's about. And has no appreciation for it. That, he says, happens. We know the reality. This also is vanity. Therefore I turn about to cause my heart to despair concerning all the labor when I had labored under the sun. Well, there's a man whose labor is with wisdom and with knowledge and with skillfulness, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. Well, temporary. Chapter 5, verses 13 and following. This is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept by the owner thereof to his hurt. And those riches perish by evil adventure. You had it today, you don't have it tomorrow. You think it can't happen, it happens. And if he hath begotten a son, there is nothing in his hand. I mean, nothing to leave the boy. As he came forth from his mother's womb, naked shall he go again as he came, and shall take nothing for his labor, which he may carry out in his hand. Do we know that? Is that a revelation? There are no pockets in the shroud. We'll not take anything with us. Whatever we have collected here and made our life, we will leave behind when we die, and that's it. Why is it that we must go over these same old 2 + 2 = 4 equations? It's not because we are so stupid that we don't recognize we're going to die one day. It's not because we are so stupid that we don't understand that these riches are temporary. It's not because we are so stupid that we don't understand that these pleasures are momentary and we can look out and see these aged, crippled people and know that they're not taking any great delight in pleasure anymore. We know all that, but we will refuse in our mind to face this reality. We will blind ourselves to that. And the only question we will ask, and this is the stupid question we ask, is what pleases me now?
What do I want now? What makes me happy now? If that's the answer you want, then the now is all you have.
And that is pathetically little. We've got to take a longer look. Face the realities we know. When we think about these things as being the answer, they're not going to be the answer. And Solomon makes many a point about this. He says the pursuit of wealth brings a lot of unhappiness. Chapter 2 and verse 22, "For what has a man of all his labor and of the striving of his heart when he labors under the sun for all his days? Or but sorrows and his travail is grief. Yes, even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity." Rich men who trust in their riches. Poor people who trust in their whatever they've got. They've got to stay awake at night trying to figure out how to hold on to it and get some more. In contrast, Solomon says, verse 12 of chapter 5, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the fullness of the rich will not suffer him to sleep." Should be a lesson there. Some of us are worrying ourselves into an early grave about things, how we can hold on to what we've got, or how we can get some more. But what he says about that whole process in chapter 5, verse 10, is that it's an endless striving that never brings satisfaction. "He that loves silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them, and what advantage is there to the owner thereof, save the beholding them with his eyes?" No advantage. This wealth, this money, does not satisfy. You'll always want more. And when you get more, you'll want more than that. And that's the reason Solomon said it's chasing the wind. And out at the end of it all, emptiness. Temporary. And even if you could keep it a long, long time, even if you keep it forever, it wouldn't satisfy you. It's a pointless grind, he said. Chapter 4, verses 7 to 8. "Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one that is alone and doesn't have a second. Yes, he has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end of all his labor, neither are his eyes satisfied with riches. For whom then, saith he, do I labor and deprive my soul of good?" What are you doing? I mean, there are people that don't have anybody to leave it to, even if it's some dumb individual who doesn't even understand what he's going to get. And yet we work and work and work like in a mindless frenzy, like squirrels in a cage. We don't even know what we're doing, but somehow or another we've got to do it because we don't have anything else to do. And we keep up this mindless pursuit, this pointless grind, and we're just grinding ourselves to dust when we were made for eternity. Made for eternity. Filled with it in God's eternal scheme of things. So I want you to think back. What is it now that's worth it all? Is it becoming wise after the ways of the world so that you are known in the hallowed halls of wisdom in every university in the world so that your books are quoted? Would that please you? You still won't know anything. That makes a difference about ultimate reality. All you have is a few guidelines for how to live under the sun, and that's it. Is it pleasure? Pleasure passes. And then the days will come when you shall say, "I have no pleasure in that." Is it money and things? Temporary? Cannot satisfy. Our true need. What is it? What did Solomon mean when he said that God had put eternity in our hearts? Well, he meant that God had put the longing for eternity in us. And not just in the sense of endless existence. We have that. We have a longing for life. Death is not a natural, acceptable thing to us.
It brings immense pain.
And anyone who says, I think it's natural and I've looked forward to it all my life. It's the way things ought to be.
It just makes me feel good when I think about it.
Why, he's whistling through the graveyard. That is dishonest. What God did for us is to put a longing for him in us. And he's the only one who can fill the emptiness. Two passages from the Psalms as an illustration of this. First, from David, written in the time of his sojourn in the wilderness of Judah, fleeing from Saul, a pilgrim under constant assault. O God, he says, you are my God. Earnestly will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So have I looked upon you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. Do you get the sense of the profound longing of this man who is running like a wild animal under the chase in the wilderness, and his heart cries out for God? The other is from the Jews of the captivity in Psalm 42. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? The only thing that can fill the emptiness of your soul and heart is God himself. That's the reason that Solomon concludes this great pilgrimage of his by saying that this is the end of the matter. Chapter 12, verse 13. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Is that not what Jesus said to him? Drawing from the wisdom of the Old Testament, the language of Moses, he said the first and greatest commandment is that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. Solomon doesn't say a great deal about this, but the second is like to it. He said, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But what he's saying is that we must make God the object and purpose of our lives. We must reach out to him. He's reaching out to us. And when we open up ourselves in humility, he'll speak to us. When we quit trying to find the answers ourselves, so that when we get through, won't it be grand? We can say, I did it my way. I did it myself. Nobody helped me. It was my doing, first or last. We're not going to do it, first of all. Well, what a stupid, arrogant attitude for a creature who can't even draw a single breath without the power of another. How much wiser it is for us to recognize our weakness and our emptiness and open up ourselves to the God who will lovingly and graciously to fill us. It's been his intention from the beginning. Are you God's child? Have you learned the wisdom that comes down from above the sun? Or are you still living under the sun, thinking you can make it here? You can't. Solomon said, you can't do it. Don't be a fool. Don't take the road I took. It was a disaster. And I'm warning you. Remember your Creator. Seek him above all things. Make your life one moment, 1 hour, 1 week after another, 1 month after another, 1 year after another, seeking God, keeping His commandments. We would invite you today, because God invites you, to come and be His child. And remember how you do it. It's not up in heaven where you got to climb up and get it. It's not down in the abyss, so you got to go down deep to find it. Paul said it's in your mouth and in your heart. If you will confess with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God has raised you from the dead, you shall be saved. And from the teaching of the book of Acts and other passages of the epistles, we know that to believe and call upon Him, we turn from our sins in penitent grief and turn to Him in humble submission and be baptized in His name for the remission of our sins. And then we can become full and complete and know peace and joy that is transcendent. Won't you seize that for yourself this morning while we're encouraging you with this hymn?